Disc 3.
Schaefer had boastfully described the garage and taxi several times during the game. He had flaunted the existence of the hideaway and sworn to the other players that it was real and not just some fantasy in a role-playing game. Jeffrey had openly dared them to see it for themselves, and that was why Bear was in Washington. "Well, Jeffrey, the hideaway is real," he agreed. "You are a stone-cold killer. You weren't bluffing, were you?" At 10 o'clock that night, Bear took Schaefer's taxi out. The keys were there, almost as a dare. Was it? He figured he had a night to experience exactly what Schaefer had experienced. According to Jeffrey, half the fun of the game was foreplay, checking out the possibilities, seeing the whole game board before you made a move. From 10 o'clock until 11:30, Bear explored the streets of D.C., but he didn't pick up a fare. He kept his off-duty sign on. "What a game," Bear kept thinking as he drove. "Is this how Jeffrey does it? Is this how he feels when he's prowling the city?" He was pulled out of his daydream by an old tramp with a crushed hat who had wheeled a cart filled with cans and other recyclables right in front of him. He didn't seem to care whether he got run over or not, but Bayer braked hard. That made him think of Schaefer. The line between life and death had faded to nothing for Jeffrey, hadn't it? Bayer cautiously moved on. He drove past a church. The service was over, and a crowd of people was leaving. He stopped the cab for an attractive black woman in a blue dress and matching high heels. He needed to see what this must be like for Schaefer. For death. He couldn't resist. "Thank you so much," the woman said as she slid into the rear of his taxi. She seemed so proper and respectable. He checked her furtively in the mirror. She didn't have much to offer up top. Pretty enough face, though. Long brown legs encased in sheer stockings. He tried to imagine what Schaefer might do now, but he couldn't. Schaefer had boasted that he was killing people in the poorer sections of Washington, since nobody cared about them anyway. Bear suspected he was telling the truth. He knew things about Schaefer from when they were in Thailand and the Philippines. He knew Schaefer's deepest, darkest secrets. Bear drove the attractive and well-spoken black woman to her apartment and was amused when she gave him a 60-cent tip for a $4 ride. 15% to the penny. He took the money and thanked her graciously. "An English cab driver," she said. "That's unusual. Have a nice evening." He continued to drive until past 2 in the morning. He drank in the sights, played the dizzying game. And then he had to stop again. 2 young girls were hailing for a taxi on the corner. The area was called Shaw, and Howard University was very close, according to several signs. The girls were slender, delectable, in stacked heels and shiny clothes that glowed in the dark. One of them wore a microskirt, and he could see the tops of black or navy thigh highs as he stopped to pick them up. "They must be hookers, Schaefer's favorite prey," Bayer thought to himself. The second prostitute was even prettier and sexier than the first. She wore white stacked bath sandals, side-striped white athletic pants, a teeny tank top in blue camouflage. "Where are we going?" Bayer asked as they scampered over to the taxi. The girl in the miniskirt did the talking. "We're going to Princeton Place. That's Petworth, darling. Then you're going away," she said. She tossed her head back and issued a taunting laugh. Bayer snickered to himself. He was beginning to get into this now. The girls climbed in, and Bear couldn't resist checking them out in the mirror. The foxy one in the microskirt caught him looking. He felt like a schoolboy, found it intoxicating, didn't avert his eyes from hers. She casually flipped him a finger. He didn't stop looking, couldn't. So this is how it felt to Schaefer. This was the game of games. He couldn't take his eyes off the girls. His heart was pounding. Microskirt wore a tightly fitted ribbed tank top. Her long fingernails were airbrushed in kiwi and mango colors. She had a pager on her belt, probably a gun in her handbag. The other girl smiled shyly in his direction. She seemed more innocent. Was she? A necklace that read baby girl dangled between her young breasts. If they were going to Petworth, they had to be hooking. They were certainly young and foxy, 16, 17 years old. Bear could see himself having sex with the girls, and the image was beginning to overpower his imagination. He knew he ought to be careful. This could get completely out of hand. He was playing Schaefer's game, wasn't he? And he liked it very much. "I have a proposition for you," he said to Microskirt. "All right, darling," she said. "Be 100 for the half, plus our ride to Petworth. That's my proposition for you." Chapter 26. Schaefer liked to know when any of the other players traveled, especially if they came to Washington. He had gone to a lot of trouble to hack his way into their computers to keep track of them. Famine had recently bought plane tickets, and now here he was in D.C. Why? It wasn't hard to follow George Bear once he got to town. Schaefer was still reasonably good at it. He'd had plenty of practice in tracking and surveillance during his years in the service. He was disappointed that Famine had decided to intersect with his fantasy. Intersection happened occasionally in the game, but it was rare. Both players were supposed to agree beforehand. Famine was clearly breaking the rules. What did he know or think he knew? Then Bear genuinely surprised him. Not only did he visit Schaefer's hideaway, but he actually took the taxi for a ride. What the hell was he doing? At a little past 2 in the morning, Schaefer watched his gypsy cab pick up 2 young girls in Shaw. Was Bear copycatting? Was he setting some kind of trap for Schaefer? Or was it something else altogether? Bear took the girls to West Street, which wasn't far from the pickup point. He followed the girls up the darkened stairs of an aging brownstone, and then they all disappeared inside. He had a blue anorak thrown over his right arm, and Schaefer suspected that a pistol was under the coat. Christ, he'd taken 2 of them. He could have been seen by anyone on the street. The cab could have been spotted. Schaefer parked on the street. He waited and watched. He didn't like being in this part of Shaw, especially without his disguise and driving the Jaguar. There were some old crumbling brownstones and a couple of boarded-up, graffiti-covered shacks on the street. No one was outside. He saw a light blink on the top floor and figured that was where Bear had taken the 2 girls. Probably their flat. He watched the brownstone from 2 until close to 4. He couldn't take his eyes away. While he waited, he imagined dozens of scenarios that might have brought Famine here. He wondered if the others were in Washington, too. Or was Famine acting alone? Was he playing the 4 horsemen right now? Schaefer waited and waited for Bear to come out of the brownstone. But he didn't come down, and Schaefer grew more impatient and worried and angry. He fidgeted. His breathing became labored. He had lurid, paranoid fantasies about what Bear might have done up there. Had he killed the 2 girls? Taken their identification? Was this a trap? He thought so. What else could it be? Still no George Bear. Schaefer couldn't stand it any longer. He climbed out of the Jaguar. He stood on the street and stared up at the windows of the flat. He wondered if he, too, were being watched. He sensed a trap. Wondered if he should flee. Christ, where the hell is Bear? What game was Famine playing? Was there a back way out of the building? If so, why had he left the taxi as evidence? Evidence! Damn him! But then he saw Bear finally leave the building. He quickly crossed S Street, got into the cab, and drove away. Schaefer decided to go upstairs. He jogged over to the building and found the wooden front door unlocked. He hurried up the steep, winding stairs. He had a flashlight in one hand and turned it on. His semi-automatic was in the other. Schaefer made his way to the 4th floor. He immediately knew which of the 2 flats was the one. A poster for Mary J. Blige's What's the 411 album was on the splintered and scarred door to his right. The girls lived here. He turned the handle and carefully pushed the door open. He pointed his gun inside, ready. One of the young girls came out of the bathroom wearing a fluffy black towel on her head, nothing else. She was a hot number with pert little titties. Christ, Famine must have paid for it. What a fool! What a wanker. Who the hell are you? What are you doing in here? The girl shouted angrily. I'm Death, he grinned, then announced, I'm here for you and your pretty friend. Chapter 27. I had gotten home from the John Doe murder scene at a little past 3:30 in the morning. I went to bed but set my alarm for 6:30. I managed to get myself up before the kids went off to school. Somebody was out very, very, very late last night. Jenny started her teasing before I had made it all the way downstairs and into the kitchen. I continued down and found her and Damon in the breakfast nook with Nana. Somebody sure looks like he had a late night, Nana said from her customary catbird seat. Somebody's cruising for a bruising, I said to quiet them. Now there's something important I need to tell you before you head out to school.
Watch our manners. Always pay attention in class, even if the teacher's boring. Lead with our left if it ever comes to a fight in the schoolyard, Jenny offered with a wink.
I rolled my eyes. What I was going to say, I said, is that you should be especially nice to Mrs. Johnson today. You see, last night Christine said that she'd marry me. I guess that means she's marrying all of us. At that point, everything became hugging and loud celebrating in the kitchen. The kids got chocolate milk and bacon grease all over me. I'd never seen Nana happier, and I felt exactly the same, probably even better than they did. I eventually made it to work that morning. I'd made some progress on the John Doe homicide, and early on Tuesday morning I learned that the man whose body had been dumped on Alabama Avenue was a 34-year-old research analyst named Franklin Odenkirk. He worked at the Library of Congress for the Congressional Research Service. We didn't release the news to the press, but I did inform Chief Pittman's office as soon as I knew. Pittman would find out anyway. Once I had a name for the victim, information came quickly, and as it usually is, it was sad. Odenkirk was married and had three small children. He had taken a late flight back from New York, where he'd given a talk at the Rockefeller Institute. The plane landed on time, and he deboarded at National around 10. What happened to him after that was a mystery. For the remainder of the week, I was busy with the murder case. I visited the Library of Congress and went to the newest structure, the James Madison Building, on Independence Avenue. I talked to nearly a dozen of Frank Odenkirk's co-workers. They were courteous and cooperative, and I was told repeatedly that Odenkirk, while haughty at times, was generally well-liked. He wasn't known to use drugs or drink to excess, wasn't known to gamble either. He was faithful to his wife. He hadn't been involved in a serious argument at the office for as long as he'd been there. He was with the Education and Public Welfare Division and spent long days in the spectacular main reading room. There was no apparent motive for his murder, which was what I had feared. The killing roughly paralleled the Jane Doe's so far, but of course the chief of detectives didn't want to hear that. There was no Jane Doe killer, according to him. Why? Because he didn't want to shift dozens of detectives to Southeast and begin an extensive investigation on the basis of my instincts and gut feelings. I'd heard Pittman joke that Southeast wasn't part of his city. Before I left the Madison Building, I was compelled to stop and see the main reading room once again. It was newly renovated, and I hadn't been there since the work had been done. I sat at a reader's table and stared up at the amazing dome high over my head. Around the room were stained glass representations of the seals of 48 states, along with bronze statues of famous figures, including Michelangelo, Plato, Shakespeare, Edward Gibbon, and Homer. I could imagine poor Frank Odenkirk doing his work here, and it bothered me. Why had he been killed? Had it been the weasel? The death was a terrible shock to everyone who had worked with him, and a couple of Odenkirk's co-workers broke down while talking to me about his murder. I wasn't looking forward to interviewing Mrs. Odenkirk, but I drove out 295 and 210 to Forest Heights late on Friday afternoon. Chris Odenkirk was home with her mother and also her husband's parents, who had flown in from Briarcliff Manor in Westchester County, New York. They told me the same story as the people at the Library of Congress. No one in the family knew of anyone who might want to harm Frank. He was a loving father, a supportive husband, a thoughtful son and son-in-law. At the Odenkirk home, I learned that the deceased had been wearing a green seersucker suit when he left home, that his business meeting in New York had run over, and that he had been nearly 2 hours late getting to LaGuardia Airport. He generally took a cab home from the airport in Washington, because so many flights arrived late. Even before I went to the house in Forest Heights, I had two detectives sent out to the airport. They showed around pictures of Odenkirk, interviewed airline personnel, shop workers, porters, taxi dispatchers, and cab drivers. Around 6, I went over to the medical examiner's office to hear the results of the autopsy. All the photos and sketches from the crime scene were laid out. The autopsy had run about 2.5 hours. Every cavity of Frank Odenkirk's body had been swabbed and scraped, and his brain had been removed. I talked to the medical examiner while she finished up with Odenkirk at about 6:30. Her name was Angelina Torres, and I'd known her for years. The two of us had started in our jobs at about the same time. Angelina was a tick under 5 feet, and probably weighed around 90 pounds, soaking wet. "Long day, Alex?" she asked. "You look used and abused." "Long one for you, too, Angelina. You look good, though. Short, but good." She nodded, grinned, then stretched her small, slight arms up over her head. She let out a low groan that approximated the way I felt, too. "Any surprises for me?" I asked, after allowing her to stretch in peace and moan her little heart out. I hadn't expected anything, but she had some news.
"One surprise," Angelina said. "He was sodomized after he died. Someone had sex with him, Alex. Our killer seems to swing both ways."
Chapter 28. On the drive home that evening, I needed a break from the murder case. I thought about Christine, and that was much better, easier on the frontal lobe. I even switched off my beeper. I didn't want any distractions for 10 or 15 minutes. Even though she hadn't talked about it recently, she still felt my job was too dangerous. The trouble was, she was absolutely right. I sometimes worried about leaving Damon and Janny alone in the world, and now Christine as well. As I drove along the familiar streets of Southeast, near Fifth, I considered whether I could actually leave police work. I'd been thinking about going into private practice and working as a psychologist, but I hadn't done anything to make it happen. It probably meant that I didn't really want to do it. Nana was sitting on the front porch when I arrived home at around 7:30. She looked peeved, an expression of hers that I know all too well. She can still make me feel like I'm 9 or 10 years old, and she's the one with all the answers. "Where are the kids?" I called out as soon as I opened the car door and climbed out. A fractured Batman and Robin kite was still up in a tree in the yard, and I was annoyed at myself for not getting it down a couple of weeks ago.
"I shackled them to the sink, and they're doing the dishes," Nana said.
"Sorry about missing dinner," I told her.
"Tell that to your children,"
Nana said, frowning up a storm. She's about as subtle as a hurricane.
"You better tell them right now. Your friend Samson called a little earlier. So did your compatriot Jerome Thurman. There's been more murders, Alex. I use the plural noun, just in case you didn't notice. Samson is waiting for you at the so-called crime scene. Two bodies over in Shaw, near Howard University, of all places. Two more young black girls are dead. It won't stop, will it? It never stops in Southeast."
"No, it never does."
Chapter 29. The homicide scene was an old crumbling brownstone in a bad section of S Street in Shaw. A lot of college kids, and also some young professionals, live in the up-and-down, mostly middle-class neighborhood. Lately, prostitution has become a problem there. According to Samson, the two dead girls were both prostitutes who occasionally worked in the neighborhood, but mostly turned tricks over in Petworth. A single squad car and an EMS truck were parked at the homicide scene. A uniformed patrolman was posted on the front stoop and seemed intent on keeping intruders out. He was young, baby-faced, with smooth butterscotch skin. I didn't know him, so I flashed my detective's shield.
"Detective Cross," he grunted. I sensed that he'd heard of me.
"What do we have so far?" I asked before I went inside to trudge up the 4 steep flights.
What do you hear, officer? 2 girls dead upstairs. Both pros, apparently. One of them lived in the building. Murders were called in anonymously. Maybe a neighbor, maybe the pimp. They're 16, 17, maybe younger. Too bad. They didn't deserve this. I nodded, took a deep breath, and then quickly climbed up the steep, winding, creaking stairs to the 4th floor. Prostitutes make for difficult police investigations, and I wondered if the weasel knew that. On average, a hooker out of Petworth might turn a dozen or more tricks a night, and that's a lot of forensic evidence just on her body. The door to apartment 4A was wide open, and I could see inside. It was an efficiency with one large room, kitchenette, bath. A fluffy white area rug lay between 2 daybeds. A lava lamp was undulating green blobs next to several dildos. Samson was crouched on the far side of one daybed. He looked like an NBA power forward searching the floor for a missing contact lens. I walked into a small, untidy room that smelled of incense, peach blossom fragrance, greasy food. A bright red and yellow McDonald's container of fries was open on the couch. Dirty clothes covered the chairs, bike shorts, short shorts, Carl Connie urban clothes. At least a dozen bottles of nail polish and remover, a couple of nail files, and cotton balls lay on the floor. There was a heavy, cloying smell of fruity perfume in the room. I went around the bed to look at the victims. 2 very young women, both naked from the waist down. The weasel had been here. I could feel it. The girls were lying one on top of the other, looking like lovers. They looked as if they were having sex on the floor. One girl wore a blue tank top, the other black lingerie. They both still wore slides, stacked bath sandals that are popular nowadays. Most of the Jane Does had been left naked, but unlike many of the others, these 2 would be fairly easy for us to identify. No actual ID on either girl, Samson said, without looking up from his work. One of them rents the apartment, though, I told him. He nodded. Probably pays cash. She's in a cash business. Samson was wearing latex rubber gloves and was bent down close to the 2 women. The killer wore gloves, Samson said, still without looking up at me. Don't seem to be fingerprints anywhere. That's what the techie says. First look through. They both were shot, Alex. Single shot to the forehead. I was still looking around the room, collecting information, letting the details of the murder scene flow over me. I noticed an array of hair products. Soft sheen, carefree curl, styling gel, several wigs. On top of one of the wigs was a green army garrison cap with stripes, commonly called a cunt cap among military personnel, because it's said to be effective for picking up women, especially in the South. There was also a pager. The girls were young and pretty. They had skinny little legs, small bony feet, silver toe rings that looked like they'd come from the same shop. Their discarded clothes amounted to insignificant little bundles on the bloodied hardwood floor. In one corner of the small room, there were vestiges of brief childhoods. A lotto game, a stuffed blue bear that was threadbare and looked about as old as the girls themselves, a Barbie doll, a Ouija board. Take a good look, Alex. It gets weirder and weirder. Our weasel is starting to freak out. I sighed and bent down to see what Samson had discovered. The smaller, and perhaps the younger, of the 2 girls was lying on top. The girl underneath was on her back. Her glazed brown eyes stared straight up at a broken light fixture in the ceiling, as if she had seen something terrible up there. The girl on top had been positioned with her face, actually her mouth, tilted down into the other girl's crotch. Killer played real cute games with them after they were dead, Samson said. Move the one on top a little. Lift her head, Alex. You see it? I saw it. A completely new M.O. for the Jane Does, at least the ones I knew about. The phrase, stuck on each other, ran through my mind. I wondered if that was the killer's message. The girl on top was connected to the one underneath by her tongue. Samson sighed and said,
I think her tongue is stapled inside the other girl. I'm pretty sure that's it, Alex. The weasel stapled them together.
I looked at the two girls and shook my head. I don't think so. A staple, even a surgical one, would come apart in the tongue's surface. Crazy glue adhesive would work, though.
Chapter 30.
The killer was working faster, so I had to do the same. The two dead girls didn't remain Jane Doe's for very long. I had their names before the 10 o'clock news that night. I ignored the explicit orders of the chief of detectives and continued work on the investigation. Early the next morning, Samson and I met at Stamford, the high school that Tory Glover and Marion Cardinal had attended. The murdered girls were 17 and 14 years old. The memory of the homicide scene had left me with a queasy, sick feeling that wouldn't go away. I kept thinking, Christine is right. Get out of this. Do something else. It's time. The principal at Stamford was a small, frail-looking, red-haired woman named Robin Schwartz. Her resource officer, Nathan Kemp, had gotten together some students who knew the victims and had set aside a couple of classrooms for Samson, Jerome Thurman, and me to use for interviews. Jerome would work in one room, Samson and I in the other. Summer school was still in session, and Stamford was busy as a mall on a Saturday. We passed the cafeteria on the way to the classrooms, and it was packed, even at 10:30. No empty seats anywhere. The room reeked of French fries, the same greasy smell that had been in the girls' apartment. A few kids were making noise, but they were mostly well-behaved. The music of Wu-Tang and Jodeci leaked from earphones. The school seemed to be well-run and orderly. Between classes, a few boys and girls embraced tenderly, with loosely locked pinkies and the gentlest brushes of cheeks.
"These were not bad girls," Nathan Kemp told us as we walked. "I think you'll hear that from the other students. Tori dropped out last semester, but her home life was the main reason. Marion was an honor student at Stamford. I'm telling you guys, these were not bad girls."
Samson, Thurman, and I spent the rest of the afternoon with the kids. We learned that Tori and Marion were popular, all right. They were loyal to their friends, funny, usually fun to be around. Marion was described as blazing, which meant she was great. Tori was buggin' sometimes, which meant she could be a little crazy. Most of the kids hadn't known that the girls were tricking in Petworth, but Tori Glover was said to always have money. One particular interview would stick in my mind for a while. Evita Cardinal was a senior at Stamford and also a cousin of Marion's. She wore white athletic pants and a purple stretchy top. Her black-rimmed, yellow-tinted sunglasses were propped on top of her head. She started to cry her eyes out as soon as she sat down across the desk from me. "I'm real sorry about Marion," I said, and I was. "We just want to catch whoever did this terrible thing. Detective Samson and I both live nearby in Southeast. My kids go to the Sojourner Truth School." The girl looked at me. Her eyes were red-rimmed and wary.
"You won't catch nobody," she finally said.
It was the prevailing attitude in the neighborhood, and it happened to be mostly true. Samson and I weren't even supposed to be here. I had told my secretary I was out working the murder of Frank Odenkirk. A few other detectives were covering for us. "How long have Tori and Marion been working in Petworth? Do you know any other girls from school who work over there?" Evita shook her head.
"Tori was the one working the street in Petworth, not Marion. My cousin was a good person. They both were. Marion was my little doggy,"
Evita said, and the tears came flowing again. "Marion was there with Tori. I told her what I knew to be the truth. We talked to people who saw her on Princeton Place that night." The cousin glared at me.
"You don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Detective. You're wrong. You ain't got the straight."
"I'm listening to you, Evita. That's why I'm here."
"Marion wasn't there to sell her body like that. She was just afraid for Tori. She went to protect Tori. She never did nothing bad for money, and I know that for a fact."
The girl started to sob again.
My cousin was a good person. My best girlfriend. She was trying to just protect Tori, and she got herself killed for it. The police won't do nothing. You never come back here again after today. Never happen. You don't care about us. We're nothing to nobody,
Evita Cardinal said. And that seemed to say it all. Chapter 31. We're nothing to nobody. It was a horrifying and absolutely true statement, and it was at the deepest roots of the Jane Doe investigation, the search for the weasel. It pretty well summed up George Pittman's cynical philosophy about the inner city. It was also the reason I was feeling tired and numb to the bone by 6:30 that night. I believe that the Jane Doe murders were escalating. On the other hand, I hadn't seen nearly enough of my own kids for the last few days, so I decided I'd better head home. On the way, I thought about Christine and calmed down immediately. Since the time I was a young boy, I've been having a recurring daydream. I'm standing alone on a cold, barren planet. It's scary, but more than anything, it's lonely and unsettling. Then a woman comes up to me. We begin to hold hands, to embrace. And then everything is all right. That woman was Christine, and I had no idea how she had gotten out of my dreams and into the real world. Nana, Damon, and Janny were just leaving the house when I pulled up into the driveway. What's this, I wondered. Wherever they were going, everybody was dolled up and looking especially nice. Nana and Janny wore their best dresses, and Damon had on a blue suit, white shirt, and tie. Damon almost never wears what he calls his monkey or funeral suit. "Where's everybody going?" I said as I climbed out of the old Porsche. "What's going on? You all aren't moving out on me." "It's nothing," Damon said, strangely evasive, eyes darting all over the front yard.
"Damon's in the Washington Boys' Choir at school," Janny proudly blurted out. "He didn't want you to know until he made it for sure. Well, he made it. Damon's a chorister now."
Her brother swatted her on the arm. Not hard, but enough to show he wasn't pleased with Janny for telling his secret.
"Hey,"
Janny said, and put up her dukes like the little semi-pro boxer that she is becoming under my watchful eye. "Hey, hey," I said, and moved in like a big-time referee, like that guy Mills Lane who does the big pro fights. "No prize fighting outside the ring. You know the rules of the fight game. Now, what's this about a choir?"
"Damon tried out for the boys' choir, and he was selected," Nana said,
and beamed gloriously as she looked over at Damon.
"He did it all by himself."
"You sing, too," I said, and beamed at him as well. "My, my, my."
"He could be in Boys to Men, Daddy. Boys to Boys, maybe. He's smooth and silky. His voice is pure."
"Is that so, Sister Soul?" I said to my baby girl.
"That so?"
Janny continued to prattle as she patted Damon on the back. I could tell she was incredibly proud of him. She was his biggest fan, even if he didn't realize it yet. Someday he would. Damon couldn't hold back a big smile. Then he shrugged it off.
"No big thing. I sing all right." "Thousands of other boys tried out," Janny said. "It is a big thing. Biggest in your small life, brother."
"Hundreds," Damon corrected her. "Only hundreds of kids tried out. I guess I just got lucky."
"Hundreds of thousands," Janny gushed,
and scooted away before he swatted her, like the little gnat she can be sometimes.
"And you were born lucky."
"Can I come to the practice?" I asked. "I'll be good. I'll be quiet. I won't embarrass anybody too much."
"If you can spare the time."
Nana threw a neat jab. She sure didn't need any boxing lessons from me.
"Your busy work schedule and all. If you can spare the time, come along with us."
"Sure, Dad," said Damon, finally. So I came along.
Chapter 32. I happily walked the 6 short blocks to the Sojourner Truth School with Nana and the kids. I wasn't dressed up. They were in their finery, but it didn't matter. There was suddenly a bounce in my step. I took Nana's arm, and she smiled as I tucked her hand into the crook of my arm. "Now that's better. Seems like old times," I exclaimed.
"You're such a shameless charmer sometimes," Nana said, and laughed out loud. "Ever since you were a little boy like Damon, you certainly can be one when you want to."
"You helped make me what I am, old woman," I confided to her.
"Proud of it, too. And I'm so proud of Damon."
We arrived at the Sojourner Truth School and went directly to the small auditorium and back. I wondered if Christine might be there, but she wasn't anywhere to be seen. Then I wondered if she already knew that Damon had made the boys' choir, if he had told her first. I kind of liked the thought that he might have told her. I wanted them to be close. I knew that Damon and Janny needed a mother, not just a father and a great-grandmother.
"We're not too good yet,"
Damon informed me before he left to join the other boys. His face clearly showed the fear and anxiety of possibly being embarrassed.
"This is just our second practice. Mr. Dane says we're horrid as a tub full of castor oil. He's tough as nails, Dad. He makes you stand for an hour straight without moving." "Mr. Dane's tougher than you, Daddy. Tougher than Mrs. Johnson," Janny said, and grinned wickedly. "Tough as nails."
I had heard that Nathaniel Dane was a demanding maestro, nicknamed the Great Dane, and that his choirs were among the finest in the country, and that most of the boys were said to profit immensely from the dedicated training and discipline. He was already organizing the boys up on the stage. He was a very broad man of below-average height. I guessed he carried about 250 pounds on his 5'7 frame. He wore a black suit with a black shirt buttoned at the collar, no tie. He started the boys off with a few playful verses of Three Blind Mice that didn't sound half bad.
"I'm really happy for Damon. He looks so proud up there," I whispered to Nana and Janny.
"He is a handsome devil, too."
"Mr. Dane is starting a girls' choir in the fall," Janny loud whispered in my ear. "You watch. I mean, you listen. I'll make it."
"Go for it, girl," Nana said, and gave Janny a hug. She is very good at encouraging others. Dane suddenly called out loudly,
"Ugh! I hear a swoop. I don't want any swoops here, gentlemen. I want clean diction and pure pitch. I want silver and silk. I do not want swoops."
Out of the corner of my eye, I suddenly saw Christine in the hallway. She was watching Dane and the boys, but then she looked my way. Her face was principal serious for just a moment. Then she smiled and winked. I walked over to see her. "Be still, my heart." "That's my boy," I said with mock proudness as I came up to her. She was dressed in a soft gray pantsuit with a coral pink blouse. God, I loved seeing her now, being with her, hanging out, doing nothing, the works. Christine smiled. Actually, she laughed a little at me.
"He does everything so damn well."
She didn't hold back, no matter what.
"I was hoping you might be here, Alex," she whispered. "I was just this very minute missing you like crazy. You know that feeling?"
"Yes, that feeling and I are well acquainted." We held hands as the choir practiced Bach's Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. Everything felt so right, and it was hard to get used to.
"Sometimes I still have this dream about George being shot and dying," she said as we were standing there.
Christine's husband had been murdered in her home, and she had seen him die. It was one of the big reasons she was hesitant about being with me, the fear that I might die in the line of duty, and also the fear that I could bring terror and violence into the house. I remember everything about the afternoon I heard Maria was shot. It eases with time, but it never goes away. Christine knew that. She had figured out the answers to most of her questions, but she liked to talk things through. We were both that way.
And yet I continue to work here in Southeast. I come to the inner city every day. I could choose a nice school in Maryland or Virginia, she said. I nodded.
Yes, Christine, you do choose to work here.
And so do you.
And so do I.
She held my hand a little tighter. I guess we were made for each other, she said. Why fight it?
Chapter 33. Early the next morning, I was back in the write-up room at the 7th District Station, working the John Doe homicide. I was the first one in there. Apparently, no one had noticed Frank Odenkirk as he was leaving the airport. His clothing still hadn't been recovered. The ME reported that he had definitely been sodomized after he was killed. As I had suspected, there was no semen. The killer had used a condom, just as with the Jane Does. The police commissioner was involved in the Odenkirk case and was putting added pressure on the department. It was making everyone angry and a little crazy. Chief Pittman was riding his detectives hard, but the only case he seemed interested in was the Odenkirk killing, especially since the suspect had been arrested in the German tourist murder. At around 11 that morning, Rakeem Powell stopped by my desk. He bent low and whispered, "Might have something interesting, Alex, downstairs in the jail, if you've got a minute. Could be a first break on those two murdered girls in Shaw." The jail was down a set of steep concrete stairs, just past a tight warren of small interrogation rooms, a holding room, and a booking room. All over the ceiling and walls, prisoners had scratched information or used black ink from their fingerprinting to write the names. This was incredibly dumb of them, since it gave us their street names for our files. It's purposely kept dark down in the jail. Each cell is 6 by 5 feet, with a metal bed and a combination water fountain toilet. Sneakers have been tossed in the hallways outside several of the cells. It's what experienced prisoners do who won't take the laces out of their sneaks. Laces aren't allowed in the jail for safety reasons. A small-time drug runner and petty thief named Alfred Sneak Streak was seated like the Fresh Prince of D.C. in one of the holding cells. The street punk looked up at me as I entered his cell. A slicky, sick smirk crossed his face. Sneak was sporting wraparound sunglasses, dusty dreadlocks, and a bright green and yellow crocheted hat. His white T-shirt had a drawing of Haile Selassie's face and read, "Headhunter, Rastafarian."
"You from the DA's office?" "I don't think so." "No dealy, no talky, my man," he said to me. "So get lost."
Rakeem ignored him as he spoke to me. "Sneak claims to have some useful information about the Glover and Cardinal homicides. He would like us to extend him some courtesy in return for what he claims to know. He's jammed up on a charge that he may have broken into an apartment in Shaw. He was caught coming out of a bedroom window with a Sony TV in his arms. Imagine that. Not very sneaky of him."
"I didn't rob no ticky-tacky apartment. I don't even watch TV, my man. And I don't see no assistant district attorney present with the authority to make a deal."
"Take off your sunglasses," I said to him. He wouldn't look at me, so I took them off for him. As one well-known street saying goes, his eyes were like tombstones. I could tell at a glance that Sneak wasn't just running drugs anymore. He was using. I stood across from Sneak in the jail cell and stared him down. He was probably in his early 20s, angry, cynical, lost in space and time. "If you didn't rob the apartment, then why would you be interested in seeing a lawyer from the district attorney's office? That doesn't make too much sense to me, Alfred. Now here's what I'll do for you, and it's a one-time offer, so listen carefully. If I walk out of here, I don't come back." Sneak half listened to what I was saying. "If you give us information that directly helps solve the murders of those two young girls, then we will help you on the robbery charge. I'll go to the map myself. If you don't give up the information, then I'm going to leave you in here with Detective Powell and Detective Thurman. You won't get this generous one-time offer again. That's another promise. And as these detectives know, I always keep my word." Sneak still didn't say anything. A glaze was coming over his eyes.
He tried to stare me down, but I'm usually better at it than the average TV booster. I finally shrugged a look at Rakeem Powell and Jerome Thurman. Okay, fine. Gentlemen, we need to know what he knows about those murdered girls in Shaw. He gets nothing from us when you're finished with him. It's possible that he's involved with the homicides himself. He could even be our killer, and we need to solve this thing fast. You treat him that way until we know differently. I started to leave when suddenly Sneak spoke.
Back door man. He hang out at Downing Park. He back door, maybe see who done those girls. That's how he say it at the park. Say he saw the killer. So how you gonna help me?
I walked out of the cell. I told you the deal, Alfred. We solve the case, your information helps, I'll help you. Chapter 34. Maybe we were close to something. Two Metro cruisers and two unmarked sedans pulled up to the fenced-in entrance of tiny Downing Playground in Shaw. Rakeem Powell and Sampson came with me to visit with Joe Backdoor Booker, a well-known neighborhood menace. I knew Backdoor by sight and spotted him right away. He was short, no more than 5'7", goateed and so good with a basketball that he sometimes played in work boots just to show off. He had on dusty orange construction boots today. Also a faded black nylon jacket and black nylon pants that accordioned at the ankles. A full-court basketball game was in progress, a fast, high-level game, somewhere between college and pro in terms of athletic ability. The court couldn't have been more basic. Black macadam, faded white lines, metal backboards, and rims with chain nets. Players from two or three other teams sat around waiting their turn to play winners. Nylon shorts and pants and the Nike swoosh were everywhere. The court was surrounded by four walls of heavy wire fencing and was known as the cage. Everybody looked up as we arrived, Booker included.
"We got next," Sampson called out.
The players on and off the court exchanged looks, and a couple of them grinned at Samson's one-liner. They knew who we were. The steady thump-thump-thump of the game ball hadn't stopped. Backdoor was on the court. It wasn't unusual for his team to hold winners for an entire afternoon. He had been in and out of reformatories and prisons since he was 14, but he could play ball. He was taunting another player who was on the court in gray suit pants and high tops, his chest bare.
"You suck," said Backdoor. "Take those church pants off. I play you in baseball, tennis, bowling, any game, you suck. Stop sucking."
Rakeem Powell blew the silver referee's whistle he always carries. Rakeem works as a soccer ref in his spare time. The whistle is unorthodox, but it gets attention in noisy places. The game stopped. The three of us walked up to Booker, who was standing near the foul circle in front of one basket. Sampson and I towered over him, but so did most of the players. It didn't matter. He was still the best ball player out there. He could probably beat Sampson and me if we played him 2-on-1.
"Oh, leave the brother alone. He didn't do nothing," one of the other taller men complained in a deep voice.
He had prison-style tattoos all over his back and arms.
"He was here playing ball, man." "Dor been here all day," said somebody else. "Dor been here for days. Hasn't lost a game in days."
Several of the young men laughed at the playground humor. Sampson turned to the biggest man on the court.
"Shut the hell up. Stop dribbling that rock, too. Two young sisters been murdered. That's why we're here. This is no game with us."
The dribbler shut up and picked up the game ball. The yard became strangely quiet. We could hear a jump rope striking the sidewalk in a fast rhythm. Three little girls playing just outside the cage were sing-songing,
"Little Miss Pinky, dressed in blue, died last night at 2:30.
It was a jump rope rhyme, and sadly true around here. I put my arm around Booker's shoulder and walked him away from his friends. Sampson continued to do the talking.
"Booker, this is going to be so fast and easy, you and your friends will be laughing your asses off about it before we're back in our cars."
"Yeah, uh-huh,"
said Joseph Booker, trying to be cool in the extreme heat of Samson's and my glare.
I'm as serious as a heart attack, little man. You saw something that can help us with the murder of Tory Glover and Marion Cardinal. Simple as that. You talk, and we walk right back out of here.
Booker glared up at Sampson as if he were staring down the sun.
I didn't see shit. Like Lukey say, I've been here for days. I never lose to these sorry chumps.
I held up my hand, palm out, inches from his squashed moon-pie face. I'm on a stopwatch here, Booker, so please don't interrupt my flow. I promise you 2 minutes, and we're out of here. Now here's what's in it for you. One, we go away, and you gentlemen finish your game. Two, Detectives Powell and Sampson will owe you one. Three, $100 now for your time and trouble. The clock is ticking, I said. Tick, tick, tick. Easy money. He finally nodded and held out his hand.
I seen those two girls get picked up around 2-3 in the morning on East Street. I didn't see no driver. Nobody's face or nothing. Too dark, man. But he was driving a cab. Looked like purple and blue gypsy, something like that. Girls get into the back of the cab, drive off.
Is that it? I asked him. I don't want to have to come back here later. Break up your game again. Booker considered what I'd said, then spoke again.
Cab driver, a white man. Seen his arm sticking out the side window. Ain't no white boys driving the night shift in Shaw. Least none I seen.
I nodded, waited a bit, then smiled at the other players.
Gentlemen, as you were, play ball.
Thump, 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 swish. Booker could really play ball. Chapter 35. The new pieces of information gave us something to run with. We'd done an incredible amount of thankless street work, and something had finally paid off. We had the color of the gypsy cab that had picked up the girls around the time of the murders. The fact that the driver was white was the best lead we had so far. Sampson and I drove to my house rather than back to the station. It would be easier to work on the new leads from Fifth Street. It took me about 5 minutes to come up with more information from a contact at the taxi commission. No fleets operating in D.C. currently had purple and blue cabs. That probably meant the cab was an illegal gypsy, as Booker had said. I learned that a company called Vanity Cabs had once used purple and blue cars, but Vanity had been out of business since 95. The taxi commission rep said that half a dozen or so of the old cars might still be on the street. Originally, the fleet had been 15 cars, which wasn't that many even if all of them were still around, which was highly doubtful. Sampson called all the cab companies that regularly did business in Southeast, especially around Shaw. According to their records, there were only 3 white drivers who had been on duty that night. We were working in the kitchen. Sampson was on the phone, and I was using the computer. Nana had fixed fresh coffee and also set out fruit and half a pecan pie. Rakeem Powell called the house at around 4:15. I picked up.
Alex, Pittman's watchdog is sniffing around here, something fierce. Fred Cook wants to know what you and Sampson are working on this afternoon. Jerome told him the Odenkirk murder.
I nodded and said, if the murders in Southeast are connected in any way, that's the truth.
One more thing, Rakeem said before he let me go. I checked with motor vehicles. Might be something good for us. A purple gypsy got a summons for running a stop sign around 1 a.m. over in Eckington, near the university, 2nd Street. Maybe that's where our boy lives.
I clapped my hands and congratulated Rakeem. Our long hours working the Jane Doe cases were finally beginning to pay off. Maybe we were about to catch the weasel. Chapter 36.
He had been much more careful lately. The visit to Washington by George Bear, famine, had been a warning, a shot over his head, and Schaefer had taken it seriously. The other players could be as dangerous as he was. It was they who had taught him how to kill, not the other way around. Famine, conqueror, and war were not to be underestimated, especially if he wanted to win the game. The day after Famine's visit, the others had informed him that Bear had come to Washington, that he was being watched.
He supposed that was his second warning. His activity had frightened them, and now they were retaliating. It was all part of the game. After work that night, he headed to the hideaway in Eckington. He spotted what looked like a half dozen or so policemen canvassing the street. He immediately suspected the other horsemen. They had turned him in after all. Or were they playing a mind game with him? What were the cops doing here? He parked the Jaguar several blocks away, then headed toward the hideaway and garage on foot. He had to check this out. He had on a pinstriped suit, city shirt, and tie. He knew he looked respectable enough. He carried a leather briefcase and definitely looked like a businessman coming home late. Two African-American policemen were doing door-to-door questioning on Euland Terrace. This wasn't good. The police were less than 5 blocks from the hideaway. Why were they here? His brain was reeling, adrenaline rushing through his nervous system like a flash flood. Maybe this had nothing to do with him, but he couldn't be too careful. He definitely suspected the other players, especially George Bayer. But why? Was this the way they planned to end the game? By bringing him down? When the two policemen up ahead disappeared down a side street off Euland, Schaefer decided to stop at one of the brownstones where they'd been asking questions. It was a small risk, but he needed to know what was happening. A couple of old men were seated on the stoop. An ancient radio played an Orioles baseball game. "They ask you about some kind of trouble in the neighborhood?" Schaefer asked the men, in as casual a tone as he could manage. "They stopped me up the block." One of the men just stared at him, terminally pissed off, but the other one nodded and spoke up.
"Sure did, mister. Looking for a cab. Purple and blue gypsy. Connected to some killings, they say, though I don't recall seeing any purple ones lately. Used to be a cab company called Vanity. You remember Earl? They had the purple people eaters." "That was some time ago," the other man said, nodding. "He went belly up."
"I guess they were Metro Police. Never showed me any ID, though," Schaefer said, and shrugged. He was being careful to speak with an American accent, which he was good at imitating.
"Detectives Cross and Sampson,"
the more talkative of the two men volunteered their names.
"Detective Cross showed me his badge. It was the real deal."
"Oh, I'm sure it was," Schaefer said, and saluted the two old men.
"Good to see the police in the neighborhood, actually." "You got that right."
"Have a nice night."
"Yeah, you too."
Schaefer circled back to his car and drove to the embassy. He went straight to his office, where he felt safe and protected. He calmed himself, then turned on his computer and did a thorough search on D.C. detectives named Cross and Sampson. He found more than he had hoped for, especially on Detective Cross. He thought about how the new developments might change the game. Then he sent out a message to the other horsemen. He told them about Cross and Sampson, adding that the detectives had decided to play the game. So naturally, he had plans for them, too. Chapter 37. Zachary Scott Taylor is a thorough, analytical, and very hard-nosed reporter on the Washington Post. I respect the hell out of him. His relentless cynicism and skepticism are a little too much for me to take on a daily basis, otherwise we might be even closer friends. But we have a good relationship, and I trust him more than I do most journalists. I met him that night at the Irish Times on F Street, near Union Station. The restaurant bar is an anachronistic, standalone brick building surrounded by modern office structures. Zachary called it a dumpy little toilet of a bar, a perfect place for us to meet. In the time-honored tradition of Washington, I have occasionally been one of his trusted sources, and I was about to tell him something important. I hoped he would agree and would convince his editors at the Post about the story.
"How are Master Damon and Miss Jenny?"
Zachary asked as he sat across from me in a darkened corner, under an old photo of a stern-looking man in a black top hat. Zachary is tall, gaunt, and thin, and resembles the man in the old photo a little bit. He always talks too fast, so that the words all run into one another. "How are Master Damon and Miss Jenny?" There was just a hint of Virginia softening his accent. The waitress eventually came over to our table.
He ordered black coffee, and I had the same.
Two coffees?
She asked, to make sure she'd heard us right. Two of your very finest coffees, Zachary said.
This isn't Starbucks, you know, she said.
I smiled at the waitress's brio, then at what Zachary had said, his first words to me. I'd probably mentioned my kids' names to him once, but he had an encyclopedic memory for all kinds of disparate information. You should go get yourself a couple of kids, Zachary, I told him, smiling broadly. He glanced up at an ancient whirling ceiling fan that looked as if it might suddenly spin out of the ceiling. It seemed a nice metaphor for modern life in America, an aging infrastructure threatening to spin out of control. Don't have a wife yet, Alex. Still looking for the right woman, said Zachary. Well, okay then. Get yourself a wife first, then get a couple of kids. Might take the edge off your neuroses. The waitress placed steaming cups of black coffee in front of us.
Will that be all? She said.
She shook her head, then left us. Maybe I don't want the edge taken off my rather stunning neurotic behavior. Maybe I believe that's what makes me such a damn fine reporter. And without it, my work would be pedestrian shit. And then I'd be nothing in the eyes of Don Graham and company. I sipped the day or two-day-old coffee. Except that if you had a couple of kids, you could never be nothing. Zachary squinted one eye shut and smacked the left side of his lips. He was a very animated thinker. Except if the kids didn't love or even like me very much. And you don't consider yourself lovable? But actually you are, Zachary. Trust me. You're just fine. Your kids would adore the hell out of you, and you would adore them. You'd have a mutual adoration society. He finally laughed and clapped his hands loudly. We usually laugh a good bit when we're together. So will you marry me and have my children? He grinned at me over the top of his steaming cup. This is a pickup joint, after all. Singles from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Government Printing Office come here, hoping to bed staffers from Kennedy's or Glands. It's the best offer I've had all day. Who called this meeting, anyway? Why are we here at this dive drinking really bad coffee? Taylor slurped his. Coffee is fairly strong, isn't it? That's something to be thankful for. What's up, Alex? You interested in another Pulitzer? I asked him. He pretended to think it over, but his eyes lit up. Well, I might be. You see, I need to balance the look of my mantelpiece. One of my dates told me that. Never did see the young woman again. She worked for Gingrich, as a matter of fact. For the next 45 minutes or so, I told Zachary exactly what I thought was up. I told him about the 114 unsolved murders in Southeast and parts of Northeast D.C. I detailed the contrasting investigations of the cases of Frank Odenkirk and the German tourist in Georgetown, and those of the black teenagers Tory Glover and Marion Cardinal. I filled him in on the chief of detectives, his proclivities and his biases, or at least my perception of them. I even admitted that I disliked Pittman intensely, and Zachary knows I'm not that way about too many folks who don't murder for a living. He shook his head back and forth, while I talked, and didn't stop when I was finished. Not that I doubt any of what you're saying, but do you have any documentation? He asked. You're such a stickler for details, I said. Reporters are such wusses when you come right down to it. I reached down under my seat and lifted up two thick manila folders. His eyes brightened. This should help with the story. Copies of 67 of the unsolved homicide reports, also a copy of the Glover and Cardinal investigation. Note the number of detectives assigned to each. Check the case hours logged. You'll see a huge discrepancy. That's all I could get my hands on, but the other reports exist. Why would this be happening, this malicious neglect? He asked me. I nodded at the wisdom of his question. I'll give you the most cynical reason, I said. Some metro cops like to refer to Southeast as self-cleaning ovens. That sound like the beginnings of malicious neglect to you? Some victims in Southeast are called NHIs. That's no humans involved. The latter is a phrase used by Chief Pittman. Zachary quickly leafed through the reports. Then he shook my hand.
I'm going home to my lonely abode, made bearable only by my single Pulitzer. I have all these fascinating police files on NHIs to read, then hopefully a chilling news expose to write. We'll see. As always, it's been a party, Alex. My best to Damon, Jan, and Nana Mama. I'd like to meet them one day, put some faces with the names. Come to the next Washington Boys Choir performance, I said. All our faces will be there. Damon is a chorister. Chapter 38. I worked late that night, until 8:30, and then I drove to Kincaid's in Foggy Bottom to meet up with Christine. Kincaid's is one of our favorite restaurants, and also an excellent place to listen to jazz and snuggle up to each other. I sat at the bar and enjoyed the sounds of Hilton Felton and Efrain Wolfhook until Christine arrived, coming from an event at school. She was right on time, though. She is punctual, very considerate, perfect in almost every way, at least in my eyes. Yes, I will be your wife. Are you hungry? Want to go to a table? I asked after we had hugged as if we'd been separated for many years and thousands of miles.
Let's just sit here at the bar for a few minutes. You mind? She asked.
Her breath smelled slightly of spearmint. Her face was so soft and smooth that I had to lightly cup it in both my hands. Nothing I'd rather do in the whole wide world, I said. Christine ordered a Harvey's Bristol Cream, and I had a mug of beer, and we talked as the music flowed over, around, and right through our bodies. It had been a long day, and I needed this. I've been waiting for this all day long. I couldn't wait. Am I being too corny and romantic again? I said, and grinned.
Not for me. Never too corny. Never too romantic. That won't happen, Alex.
Christine smiled.
This book is continued on Disc 4.